It is Monday, January the 2nd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, another deadly attack in Turkey. Could it be the leader of the country's fault?
Yes, I think it's unfair to put all the blame on him, obviously. Turkey is in a difficult neighborhood. It faces really strong challenges from Syria and Iraq, and much of that is not of its own choosing.
Also ahead, new doubt about U.S. president-elect about the alleged Russian computer hacking, random changes in temperature, plus the death of a renowned musical entrepreneur. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkish police have struggled to track down a gunman who attacked New Year's Eve revelers. It happened at a popular Istanbul nightclub, killing at least 39 people, most of them foreigners. Close to 70 others were wounded. An estimated 600 people were celebrating inside the club, which is often frequented by celebrities and tourists. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, and Turkish officials did not comment on the possible identity or motives of the gunman. The mass shooting followed more than 30 violent acts over the past year in Turkey, which is a member of the NATO alliance and a partner in the U.S.-led coalition fighting against the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. The country endured multiple bombings in 2016, including three in Istanbul alone that authorities blamed on IS. There was also a failed coup attempt in July and a renewed conflict with Kurdish rebels in the southeast. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Deakin University scholar Greg Barton if Turkey is now ground zero for terrorism.
Unfortunately, it's looking that way, Victor. There's a strong correlation around the world between the breakdown of good governance and the extent to which terrorist groups can embed themselves. We see this with Nigeria, obviously with Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia. Unfortunately, Turkey is joining in that list. In the last 3 or 4 years, between 70% and 80% of all terror deaths have occurred in those 5-6 countries. It looks like in 2017 that Turkey is going to be another one of those countries where the slide away from democracy and good governance in the name of security actually undermines its own security.
Are you putting some of the blame on President Recep Tayyip Erdogan?
Yes, I think it's unfair to put all the blame on him, obviously. Turkey is in a difficult neighborhood. It faces really strong challenges from Syria and Iraq, and much of that is not of its own choosing. But the president does deserve some blame, in my opinion, because he has pandered to radical Islamist sentiment as a way of pushing his own partisan political position. He's been very fixated ever since not getting the result he wanted in the June 2015 election. It went to a runoff in November, but even then he was disappointed. He's been fixated in pushing forward a referendum that would give him really unfettered executive authority as president. At the moment, he only has a titular authority. He would end up with powers roughly similar to Vladimir Putin in Russia, and that seems to be his role model. He's proposing a referendum in April, and to justify that very strong move, he's saying that Turkey can't survive without a strong leader. Now, the July 15 coup attempt last year gave him the opening to purge his opponents. He said this is a gift from God. He's going to cleanse the military and security forces. He's sacked 125,000 people. 40,000 have been formally charged. Another similar number are in detention, and the rest sacked. That includes many leading generals, senior police, intelligence people. Most of the media is now no longer functioning. Many journalists have been jailed. Many writers, civil society activists, etc. So he's really destroyed the democracy he's built, and it's clear that there are connections between that running down of good government and opening up of security challenges. ISIS is not Erdogan's fault, but years of playing with ISIS and similar Salafi jihadi groups, partly to put pressure on Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and then partly because it was a way of distinguishing his own claims as being an Islamic leader. It seems like that game has come home to roost, that Turkey's now paying a very stiff price. No one wants this, least of all Erdogan, but it does seem to be a direct connection between gutting the security community of its best and brightest, stifling dissent, pandering to radical Islamist rhetoric, and turning a blind eye on ISIS and other Salafi jihadi networks in Turkey, sort of playing with fire, effectively, and then hoping that he wouldn't be burnt by the fire. And so I think it's sad to say a lot of the current challenges facing Turkey are brought upon them because of one man's political ambition.
If you had the chance to advise him, what policy changes would you recommend?
Well, the first thing I would say is he achieved an enormous amount in a decade as prime minister with a new party, the most successful party and the most successful prime minister. And that was based upon Turkey modelling Islamic democracy and building an open society for all. It was, of course, trying to join the EU and orientated itself very much to Europe. It's been disappointed by that move to Europe, and Erdogan has turned his back on democracy. So the first advice would be to go back to the things that he was doing well, because that is what makes Turkey strong, and that's what gives it its best and most secure future. The second thing is immediately to stand up to these radical Islamist networks that are in Turkey. The authorities know a good deal about them. They are challenging to get rid of, and it's understandable that there's been a crisis of political will in facing up to the challenge, but now there's no longer any backing away from the problem. The assassination of the Russian ambassador, the catastrophic massacre in the nightclub on January 1, these recent events in the last 2 weeks point to the fact that, that now's the time to grasp the nettle. And to look at re-engaging with the security community, because it's something that any nation would find hard to deal with these challenges, having your best and brightest sacked or imprisoned at a time of great crisis is just not good policy. So it's hard to imagine him taking this advice. It would be, in his view, no doubt an immediate loss of face, but it would be the best thing for his own reputation and for his nation.
Greg Martin is chairman of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia. He's also a prolific author on the subjects of terrorism and counterterrorism, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump is casting new doubt on the U.S. intelligence conclusion that Russia meddled in the presidential election through computer hacking, a finding that led President Obama to impose sanctions on Russian spy agencies last week and expel 35 diplomats he said were spies. Mr. Trump told reporters it would be unfair to make allegations against Moscow if there was any uncertainty about the hacking. VOA asked former U.S. Ambassador and East-West Institute Chief Executive Cameron Munter for his read on how the Trump administration might deal with Russia and deal with the U.S. intelligence community contention that there was Russian computer hacking during the national election in November.
If after a study of this, which a lot of people are calling for, kind of a commission to study it, if we find that there was an attempt, a real attempt by the Russians to undermine American democracy, that would just, you know, add to the mistrust and the difficulty of finding common ground between Russia and America on things like ISIS and on other international issues. So it's going to be a real challenge for the new administration to work on finding common ground. Now, you can argue that by asking Mr. Tillerson to be Secretary of State designee by some of the statements that the president-elect has made, that he's thinking hard about a relationship with Russia. But finding where the common ground is. Just saying we're going to have common ground is not enough. You have to really study the problems and find out what do we have in common, in which ways can we work together, and if there's this kind of evidence of Russian meddling in the U.S. election, it's going to be just that much harder for Americans to trust Russians and make them make themselves able to work with them. So I think one of the biggest tasks after January 21st is going to be how the Trump administration figures out how it's going to work on many fronts at once to find the proper coalition of people with whom it shares values. Doing it on your own is something I think everyone agrees doesn't work.
As former U.S. Ambassador, now East-West Institute Chief Executive, Cameron Munter. Staying with the subjects of President-elect Trump and Russia hacking, we turn to my colleague Lori London for some social media response. Hey, Lori, it appears that Mr. Trump is not about to give up his love for the 140-character communication on Twitter.
You've got that right, Steve. He started with a New Year wish on Saturday by tweeting, "Happy New Year to all, including to my many enemies and those who fought me and lost so badly that they just don't know what to do." And then he wrote the word love apostrophe.
I mean, that got a lot of attention.
It did. And a ton of attention. And most people were kind of upset that he used the word enemies rather than opponents.
Yeah.
But that has quickly shifted now. So now he's got a whole new topic trending.
Oh, what's that?
Following that comment you were talking about that he made to reporters about having new information on election hacking. That's drawing quite a bit of attention on social media, on Twitter in particular. There is now the hashtag TrumpLeaks, which is trending. We're seeing comments like this from former Obama advisor David Axelrod. He tweeted, "Wow, maybe @RealDonaldTrump has found the 400-pound hacker." That's referring to Donald Trump's suggestion a while back that it could be some 400-pound person sitting in their home that actually did the election hacking. Other comments, also somewhat humorous. One person said, "Trump promises a revelation, but he won't tell us about it today. You have to wait, because it's how a presidency-elect reality show works." And, Steve, it was harder to find tweets defending Trump on this one, but I did dig up a few. This person writes, "Follow hashtag TrumpLeaks for all the latest on the left's fortune-style Trump-Russia conspiracy thread for fun." Also, we saw celebrating the new year, we're patriotic and fired up for @RealDonaldTrump.
Well, you know, Lori, the thing that amazes me is that he is the president-elect, and he's the first one to really tweet a great deal. So, I mean, he tweets comical things. He tweets serious matters. And a lot of us are not frequent users of Twitter, not to, you know, to minimize its importance. So, therefore, you know, we're not really savvy with where somebody with his sort of power and influence might be going with comments sometimes. And we all know that if we're looking eye to eye at one another, we can usually tell if somebody's joking or not, even though they're saying something that sounds serious. You can't do that with just words, you know, unless you put a smiley face or a ha-ha or something. So not to necessarily defend him, but at the same time, he has said things that have probably been misunderstood.
Get used to it, because apparently the tweeting will continue once he enters the White House on Sunday.
Oh, really?
Incoming White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer told ABC's This Week that Trump intends to continue tweeting and delivering policy announcements via social media.
My goodness.
So there you have it.
Yeah. Whole new paradigm.
That's right.
Yes, indeedy. Many thanks, Lori. International Edition's Lori London. By the way, you can follow Lori on Twitter @LoriLondon. London is spelled LUNDIN. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter @VOA_IE. Well, while we're on the subject of President-elect Trump, he was named, as you probably know, but if you don't, I'll tell you now, Time Magazine's Person of the Year for 2016, which came as little surprise after an election campaign that at times transfixed Americans and millions around the world. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone joins us now, looking back on one of the major stories of the year just passed and some of Mr. Trump's challenges as the incoming 45th president.
I see a woman in the night with a Donald Trump's journey to the White House began in June of 2015 with a campaign announcement befitting his reputation as a master showman and with a simple message that excited his supporters.
I am officially running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
Wow. Trump was controversial from the start, promising a crackdown on illegal immigration and initially proposing a ban on Muslims wanting to come to the United States. Underestimated by his Republican rivals, Trump built his brand as a political outsider and swept through an experienced primary field that included feisty debate clashes like this one with former Florida Governor Jeb Bush.
This is a tough business run for president.
Oh, no, you're a tough guy, Jeb.
And we need to have a leader that is
real tough.
You're never going to be president of the United States by insulting your way to the presidency.
Well, let's see, I'm at 42 and you're at 3, so far I'm doing better.
Doesn't matter.
In the race for the Democratic Party nomination, Hillary Clinton prevailed after a much tougher than expected primary challenge from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
A campaign finance system which is corrupt.
Once she secured the nomination, Clinton sought to cast Trump as unfit to be president.
A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons.
But on election night, Trump stunned the world with a victory few had predicted over the heavily favored Clinton. In his victory speech, Trump sounded a conciliatory tone after a divisive campaign.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people.
Clinton also urged her supporters to respect the outcome.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead.
One of the keys to Trump's victory was a desire for change, says analyst Tom DeFrank.
I think we all, including the media, but everybody, misunderestimated, as George W. Bush might say,
right.
The profound desire for change. And in the end, Trump, with all his imperfections, with all his blemishes, was the only perceived agent of change.
Trump will take office with the advantage of Republican control of Congress, says John Fortier.
And I think that allows him to have an agenda that goes forward on domestic policy and legislation, where a Hillary Clinton would have had a harder time with divided government doing those things.
Trump must now balance a desire to deliver on promises to his core supporters while at the same time trying to bring the country together after one of the most divisive elections in U.S. history. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And we're going to be thriving as a country, thriving. It can happen.
And many thanks to you, Jim Malone, so much for that. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests random temperature fluctuations in Earth's surface and within its mantle could have kickstarted our planet's moving plate tectonic system rather than being predetermined during its formation. Research based on new mathematical modeling proposes that these unique plate tectonics may be the reason why Earth is habitable, unlike the three other terrestrial planets of our solar system. Study co-author Matthew Weller, a geologist at the University of Texas at Austin, says that the new findings could change how scientists understand how planets and perhaps life itself can evolve. He says modeling planetary evolution may help scientists not only understand our own solar system, but Earth-like extrasolar planets as well. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. You know, it's about time now to go to our music department for a little something about a band manager, a nightclub owner as well, and a musical group whose songs and production were a little rough in the early days of performing, but they went on to greatness.
Well,
right, it's the Beatles 55 years ago at the Star Club in Hamburg, Germany, where they got their start, thanks to their first manager, Alan Williams, who was a fixture on the English music scene. Williams died Friday at the age of 86. He once talked about getting the Beatles a contract in Hamburg to perform nightly.
Anybody who knows the history of the Beatles, if it hadn't been for Hamburg, there would be no Beatles. The work there was so fantastically hard. They would work 7 nights a week. Sometimes they would play at, maybe open up at 7 o'clock, and at 3 o'clock there was, in the morning, they'd still be on stage. And people say to me, Alan, tell us the secret of how to be a Beatle. I say, go to Germany for 6 months, work 7 nights a week, 8 hours a night, and then come back and ask me the same question.
William said the Beatles' days at the Star Club in Hamburg were when they were young and hungry.
You know, they had no microphone stands. And I always remember this occasion when George came up the steps because they were playing in the basement. And he said, do you have a brush, Alan? I said, yes, of course. And possibly a mop? I said, yes, but I said, the basement's clean. He said, no, it's okay. And then I went down, because I was curious, in the evening. And there they have the mics tied to the brushes, and their girlfriends were holding the mics up. That's how poor they were, you know.
Here's an example of one of the nights in Hamburg at the Star Club when the Beatles sang into microphones that were mounted on mop sticks. Williams managed the Beatles for the years they were in Hamburg and even offered them performance dates at his nightclub, the Jacaranda. One afternoon, the guys were fooling around and coming up with what would eventually become the Beatles' first hit in 1962, Love Me Do. Not sounding the best there, but the Beatles went on with Love Me Do. Big hit for them. 62, that was long before they came to the United States, but they went on to sell millions and millions of albums, so I guess they got better along the way. Moving along now, the famed New York City Carnegie Deli. Well, guess what? Its doors are closed. If you've ever been there, you know it's a disaster. If you haven't been there, let me tell you, it was a disaster. You should have gone. The place wasn't a disaster. It's a disaster that it's closed. They had these giant pastrami sandwiches, one huge sandwich about 8 inches thick. Amazing. Marion Harper owns the Carnegie.
Well, I want to go in a different direction right now. The day-to-day operation is very grueling and tiresome after some 40 years. And now I'd like to concentrate on licensing the Carnegie Deli iconic brand.
Yeah, the Carnegie Deli has remained a very popular tourist destination for years, decades, let me tell you. It's a part of the pop culture scene there. Scenes from Woody Allen's Broadway Danny Rose were shot at the eatery, and the deli even named a sandwich after the actor. Walter Parrish is a longtime Carnegie customer.
Well, I think Carnegie Deli is a throwback to a bygone era in New York. The food is spectacular. It's reasonably priced. You get a lot of it. And it's here in a historic area. So it everything that is New York is embodied in this restaurant.
Yeah, in fact, that deli is just blocks from the famed Carnegie Hall in New York City. Lots of performers have been there. You know, Benjamin Bodner, well, he has fond memories of the Carnegie Deli, and he came by just to say goodbye.
It's an absolute tragedy. I came back into town just to pay my final respects, and wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, indeedy. Naomi Cordova, she's not too happy. Hardly ever let a week go by without stopping by the Carnegie just to get a bite to eat.
I'm a New Yorker. I was born and raised in New York, and I've been coming here for so many years, having meals here for over so many years, so many decades. I'm not going to tell you my age, but I am high up there in age. And this is a New York landmark and a great eatery. So many people have eaten here. I've had great, wonderful memories here.
Yes, indeedy. I'm not going to tell you my age either, but I've been going there about 45 years, so you can tell I'm not a spring chicken anyway. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today on The Voice of America. It's been International Edition. By the way, Top World News is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains committed to protecting religious minorities, their communities, and their culture worldwide. This is an important expression of the values of the United States, in that we want to protect diversity of thought and belief, said Knox Thames, Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South Central Asia. This effort, said Special Advisor Thames, is of great importance in Syria and Iraq, where ISIL or Daesh seek to wipe out much of civilizational history.
In that work, we saw where Daesh was committing genocidal acts against Christians, Yazidis, and Shia Muslims. At the same time that they were killing people, they were also trying to erase any evidence that they ever existed, destroying their churches, their mosques, their cemeteries. And if we were going to defeat Daesh militarily, we also need to take steps to protect the places that matter to these people that they're also trying to exterminate. And so from that work, we started focusing on protecting the cultural heritage of religious minorities.
The U.S. State Department partnered with the Smithsonian Institution to engage religious minority groups directly, providing them with training and information on preserving cultural sites and objects that are at risk. Some of these preventative methods are simple but effective, said Special Advisor Thames.
There was a training that went on in northern Syria where churches were trained about how to stack sandbags in front of ancient frescoes and murals so that if a mortar shell were to land, the explosive force would be dissipated by the sandbags. It wouldn't hurt the mural. And they had these very striking before and after pictures of a room full of sandbags. The bomb tragically hit. The sandbags are exploded, but the mural is fine.
Trainings also include information on protecting movable artifacts by creating digital documentation of the items that can be stored remotely. The Smithsonian Institute has created a special outreach program in Erbil, Iraq, that is dedicated to the effort. These communities that are so unique, that create this mosaic of culture and religion, said Special Advisor Thames, they can be pieced together, and protecting their common culture can be a way to do that.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.